Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Central Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Nick C., one of the hosts of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Christopher Fort about his new translation, Night and Day, by Abdulhamid Sulaimon Oghli Chopan. Dr. Fort holds a PhD in Slavic Languages and Literatures from the University of Michigan and an MA in Russian Area Studies from Ohio State University. His dissertation explores the relationship between Russian and Uzbek socialist realist literature in the 20th century. He argues that, while deeply influenced by Russian socialist realist forms, Uzbek socialist realist literature developed in a unique fashion that reflected both local traditions and the literary innovations of Uzbekistan's turn-of-the-century Muslim reformers. In addition to translating Night and Day, he is also the translator of the Uzbek author Isjan Sultan's The Eternal One. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you, and I'm really excited today to talk about your newest translation. But before we get into that, I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about your educational background, how you got interested in Central Asia, and specifically in kind of Uzbek literature in the early part of the 20th century.
Sure. Well, you hit on my degrees there, so I guess I can really start with how I became interested in Uzbek. And that all started during undergrad when I was at Michigan State. I actually ran out of my main interest was Russian, but I ran out of Russian classes after 3 years. And so I went to the advisor wanting to take another language, and I wanted to take Serbian, but she told me that they didn't have Serbian, but they had Uzbek, and I should take that because that's a less commonly a critical language. And I knew that Uzbekistan was in the Soviet Union. That was about all I knew. And so I figured because it was in the Soviet Union, it's probably similar to Russian. That turned out not to be the case. But I really fell in love with the language. And especially when I started reading the literature, when I became proficient enough to do that, I actually started reading some of it in Russian translation. I fell in love with it, and I thought that this would be kind of a niche thing to do. So that's really how my interest in Central Asia started.
And so in the introduction, I mentioned that this is actually your second published translation. So how did you decide that translating was the kind of work you wanted to pursue? And why did you first choose Isjan Sultan's The Eternal Wanderer? Is there any connection between doing that translation that then brought you to Chopin's work? Or are they, you know, is there some kind of connection there?
Okay. So this kind of has two parts, I guess. I'll start with just the interest in translation in general. Well, there really aren't enough works of Central Asian literature in translation, which makes it very difficult to teach Central Asian literature in an English language classroom. So that was part of my goal in translating both of those novels. And with both of them, and with Jolpan especially, when I first read it, it appeared to me that, you know, after having read so much socialist realism, Jolpan was one of the first things that I'd said to myself that this needs to be in English. The socialist realist stuff, not so much. And then regarding why I chose Issa-Jol Soltan first, I actually didn't choose him first. That I actually finished the translation, or at least like the first draft or manuscript for Jolpan first. It's just The Eternal Wonder happened to come out first. The process was quicker. It was a shorter novel.
I was curious by something you just said, which is, and I think this will be a good way to get into talking about the translation we're looking at today. You mentioned that Chopin's work, especially Night and Day, stood out in contrast to a lot of the socialist realist literature that you had read. And I'm curious, like, what are the differences between these? And is that a result of the time in which Chopin was writing? Or is there something specific about him as a writer?
Well, I think both your answers are right there, that it's both something specific about him as a writer and about the time in which he was living. So in the introduction, I make the argument that he finished writing this and submitted to a contest in 1934. And around this time, like from 1932 to 1934, there's what you might call a mini-thaw under Stalin, that a lot of the five-year plan had stopped momentarily. The purges had stopped. And there was this general time of reconciliation in which a lot of the authors who were persecuted thought that, well, maybe now is the time to reconcile. Maybe now it will be okay. And Chopin seems to have been pursuing this. And so I make the argument that he was trying to write a socialist realist novel, one that would be canonized and accepted into the Uzbek canon. But What socialist realism was or was to be at this point was very much up for debate. And so he presented a very unique vision of it, one that's based within his own oeuvre or within his own vision of what is art. And that's what makes him stand out from a lot of his contemporaries, especially the first generation of Uzbek socialists who were very much in the mode of that politicized Stalinist literature. He was not. He was more an aesthete. Or Chopin was more an aesthete.
And you mentioned that kind of in I think in a second I want to dive deeper into Chopin's kind of background, like his educational background, where he was during the revolution. But in your introduction, you also mentioned another really famous Uzbek writer from this period, Abdullah Qadiri. Most famous for his Otgan Kunlar, Bygone Days. And you mentioned that kind of in popular Uzbek imagination, especially among like avid readers, Chopin's work has been kind of overshadowed by Abdullah Qadiri's, I think, Bygone Days especially. I was wondering, why is that the case? How would you compare these two works? And is there a case to be made for sharing or kind of devoting more attention towards the work of Chopin and why?
I definitely think there's a case to be made to devoting more attention to Chopin. I think that Abdullah Qadiri is so venerated in the Uzbek tradition because he's the first. He's the first novelist, the first person to figure out how to put together or to take extant material from, say, folk tales or kind of folk myths or folk narrative structures and put it into a novelistic form. I personally don't find his narrator to be as engaging as Chopin's. I don't think Chopin has mastered this excellent mix of kind of dramatic irony, dramatic tension, poetry and prose, and humor. And that's not something I see as much in Qadiri. Qadiri has some of it. And so for that reason, I would put Chopin above Qadiri, but I know a number of Uzbeks would not agree with.
And so if we step back and talk about kind of, I kind of want to recreate the world in which Chopin is operating. And he's born in the late Imperial Russian kind of Central Asia. Does his profile, does his educational background, his family background compare to someone like Abdul Qadiri? And also what can these What does his life tell us about kind of the late empire or the experience of revolution in Central Asia?
So absolutely, his background, his educational background, I believe, is more or less the same as that of Abdullah Qadiri. I don't recall offhand where Abdullah Qadiri was born, but Chopin, of course, was born in Andijan in the Fergana Valley. Chopin must have gone to a maktab. I didn't find any information about that, but I know his father then, after that initial primary school, enrolled him in a madrasa. But he soon changed his mind and enrolled him in a Russian school. There were these native, or what we're trying to remember though, how they're translated into English, native schools that the Russians had set up that would teach classes in Russian, or that would teach the sciences in Russian, but also have classes in the native language. And that more or less matches what Abdullah Qadiri's background was. Abdullah Qadiri also went to one of those native schools.
And so, yeah, this puts him as kind of an educated Central Asian. Is he still in the Fergana Valley when the revolution takes place, or has he moved to Tashkent or something?
I know he goes to Kokand and is part of the Kokand autonomy, the very brief Kokand autonomy that is set up after the October Revolution and then almost immediately crushed by the Tashkent Soviet, which was pretty virulently racist, and Lenin and Stalin later put a stop to it. But yes, so he's involved in the revolution. He's involved in first this Kokand autonomy. Later, he has these. He doesn't participate in the civil war, but he later laments the violence of it, and he does. It's hard to say to what extent he supports the Basmachi in the Russian civil war, but he does elegize their defeat in a kind of romantic sense that the nation has lost something.
And is this in a published work, or that seems kind of surprising that he's publishing this? What, in 1920?
This is the early 1920s, so that was allowable. The Russians didn't have that much control over what was being published. And I think Khalid's book speaks to that quite a bit when he analyzes Fitrat, especially another Muslim reformer, like and actually kind of Chopin's mentor.
And so when does Chopin start to, so obviously he's writing throughout this period, when does he kind of make the mark as kind of a Soviet writer, or when does he start kind of publishing for like a broad Soviet public, or does he ever? I'm not really sure.
Bit of a question I'll have to take in pieces, I guess. So
yeah, sure.
He becomes kind of Uzbekistan's premier poet in the early 1920s. And at this time, he's writing these elegiac lyrics, sometimes elegizing the Basmachi, but also elegizing national loss. He's well-liked by a lot of the poets within Uzbekistan, and they emulate him. Then towards the end of the 1920s, as Stalinism ramps up and the party is confident that it can take control in Central Asia, Chopin becomes the most notorious of Uzbek poets, and he's universally reviled by the socialist poets. They still seem to like his art, but they just hate his politics. And so there's actually a lot of sort of parodies of him, what are naziras. These it's not exactly a parody, it's more of an answer to a poem. And so a lot of these socialist poets are writing answers to him. So he only becomes kind of if you will, a socialist poet, like writing in support of the Soviet Union in the 1930s. And I use some of his poetry to make the argument that he wrote this novel to be a socialist realist novel, because in the 1930s, his poetry is kind of rejecting that previous elegiac personage, saying that he's optimistic now about the future of the Soviet Union. He praises Lenin, he praises Stalin. So yeah, at that point, he becomes a Soviet poet. Now, the question of whether he's writing for a mass public is another one. Because very few people were literate in our sense of the word literate in Central Asia at this time, which is why reformers like Chopin so focused on drama. Poetry was more for their inner circle, I suppose.
And so does this switch that takes place when he starts? So in the introduction, you mentioned that he writes this novel kind of for some kind of socialist competition, right? And you see this as a crucial moment when he becomes kind of a Soviet writer. What was his work like up until that point? I know he was mostly writing poetry. Can you tell us a little bit more of what his work looked like up until the writing of Night and Day?
Okay, so he's mostly writing poetry. That's what he's best known for. Although it doesn't have that large of an output. But it's substantial, I suppose. He's also known as a dramatist. Actually, in 1924, he goes to Moscow and joins the Uzbek drama school there. And it's never been confirmed whether he meets Meyerhold or not, but I think he does. At least he's working in the same circles. And so he returns to Uzbekistan as a dramatist and has quite a few dramas that he pens and that are performed. Not many of them have survived. I think there's only three. And so that's what he's best known for. This is his first, in the 1930s, he writes his first novel. Actually, in the late 1920s, with his drama, he is more or less pro-Soviet as well. There are these moments where, like, there's these kind of, where he kind of questions his own political beliefs, where he questions the Soviet beliefs, and I write about that. Where he questions Soviet politics, and I write about that in the introduction as well. But it does seem like in the 1920s as well, he's trying to be a Soviet, in the late 1920s, trying to be a Soviet writer.
Right. And you said that, like, in the introduction, you mentioned that, like, a lot of his writing kind of demonstrates a little bit of indecisiveness or even, like, a kind of rejection of this typical kind of socialist narrative of people gaining, like, consciousness. Is that something that you also see in Night or Night and Day in your translation? Or does his switch towards, like, kind of a more pro-Soviet line also change this theme that's running throughout his work regarding consciousness of the characters?
Yeah, it's more the former, that he is trying to be politically correct, if you will, or to toe the Soviet line, but at the same time, he's very committed to his aesthetic. And that is an aesthetic of kind of indecisiveness of showing these characters almost as real people that are undecided. There's no future goal that is preordained that they're going to arrive at. Instead, there's no utopia at the end of the day. It's something that always eludes his characters. And that's what I see in Night. That's what I see in one of the dramas that I talk about in the introduction, one of the dramas of the late 1920s that he writes, but it's never published. So yeah, there's this general pro-Soviet orientation, except for that idea that utopia eludes us.
And, you know, once again, before we get into the novel, I kind of wanted you to elaborate on another point you make, which is about kind of that there's a camp of Uzbek socialist writers on which Chopin is initially on the outside and then maybe is trying to join at some point. How does Jadidism, this kind of like Muslim reform movement, fit into Chopin's work? Is the tension between these writers, Jadids on the one hand and socialist writers on the other hand, or kind of what drives these kind of polemical debates happening in the late 1920s and early 1930s among Uzbek writers?
Sure. Okay. I should probably explain who Jadids are, like, very briefly.
Yeah, please.
That was something I skipped over earlier. So people of Chopin's generation, men and women who were educated like he was, like often in these Russian schools, became what were then called Jadids, who pioneered or who were united by their common interests in a new method of teaching the Arabic alphabet, phonetic rather than syllabic. But they were also united by a general broader outlook of reform of their societies. They believed that their societies were in decline from a previous civilizational peak, and their job as Muslim reformers was to return piety to their people and bring about another civilizational peak. And so in the early 1920s, a number of these Jadids, not Chopin though, joined the Bolshevik party and used the Bolsheviks to achieve some of their goals of restoring their civilization, or as they were then calling it, because they were influenced by the European idea of nationalism, their Central Asian nation. So they're doing this in the early 1920s. Towards the mid-1920s, the Bolsheviks no longer need to collaborate with native actors. They have a new generation of Uzbek socialists who have now been trained through the Komsomol, the Communist Youth League, and other institutions that, and this new generation now believes in Soviet ideology. So the party makes a push to oust these Central Asian Jadids and put in their this new generation. It's my belief, and I think it's Khalid's belief as well, Adib Khalid, the author of Making Uzbekistan, a recent major book, that this new socialist generation believed many of the same things that the Jadids did, especially about the central or about their nation, that they were there as an intellectual vanguard in order to bring about the in order to raise the consciousness of the nation. They simply thought that Jadids were too complacent, not radical enough, but they also accused them of not understanding the true nature of the movement of history, the social or Marxist history. So that was one point of the conflict between Jadids and socialists. Just different ideas on the urgency of needing to bring about the rebuilding of the nation. And then another point is just personal competition. That Stalinism encouraged people to denounce the previous generation in order to better their own position. And so that's what a lot of these young Uzbek socialists are doing. They're denouncing people like Joel Pon in order to garner prestige for themselves. Yeah, so those are the two big things, I think, that drive the conflict.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And this is important because this helps us to kind of understand, I think, the context in which Chopin finally writes Night, which is published, I think, in 1934. So I'm wondering if you can tell us, like, how does, in your opinion, how does Chopin's Night fit in with kind of the rise of socialist realism? Is it a socialist realist novel? We see a lot of important themes here about women's liberation, about kind of the nature of colonialism, resistance. We could even possibly talk about this being a post-colonial novel in some ways. So I'm wondering, like, in your opinion, how does this relate to socialist realism? Would you call Chopin's work a socialist realist novel? And if so, why? If so, if not, why not?
I don't think I would call it a socialist realist novel, but I think at this time, 1934, it wasn't published then. He finished writing it then and submitted it to this contest. It was published in 1936. So at this time in 1934, so what socialist realism was still being decided. And so Night is a potential socialist realism that didn't pan out. Once socialist realism, as we know it today, was kind of codified, solidified, became, and there was a dogmatic interpretation of it. Once that happened, so socialist realism was codified, solidified, and had a dogmatic interpretation to it only in the late 1930s. And it was then that Chopin's novel was denounced in 1937 as not fitting this dogmatic interpretation of socialist realism. And the author was denounced as well and eventually executed. So, yes, I wouldn't call it a socialist realist novel just because socialist realism is normally understood by that dogmatic interpretation.
And so if it's not a socialist realist novel, then what does I don't know, you mentioned that like part of your hopes in translating this book is that it'll serve as kind of a way to teach Central Asian literature to undergraduate students who don't know Uzbek. And I'm wondering, like, what kind of lessons do you think reading this kind of literature can tell us about either the 1930s, the 1920s, or even pre-revolutionary Central Asia? What are the big themes that we should pull out of Chopin's work?
Well, there's certainly the question of coloniality or post-coloniality. You earlier suggested that this novel might be termed a post-colonial novel. So Chopin gives us a certain picture of what colonial life was like under the Russian Empire. And you could read certain things about, or you could read a certain allegory. I tend not to, but other author or other commentators have read an allegory about how that colonialism continues under the Soviet Union. So there's that.
Do you care to elaborate a little bit on that? So what do those scholars say, and how would you, how do you read it differently? These are the kind of fun details that we want to.
So in the introduction, I think I briefly mentioned that a lot of other scholars have read this novel. A lot of other scholars have read this novel as an allegory for the Soviet Union's corruption or kind of crushing of native Uzbeks, what have you. I tend not to read it in that way, precisely because I think he was trying to put forward a novel that would work with socialist realism or that would support the Soviet state, more or less. He was just committed to his aesthetic, and that's what would make the novel incompatible with what later would become socialist realism.
And so, but what about some of the other issues that we see? So, for instance, you know, the book is kind of centered around a woman who's kind of forced into a marriage. So there's a lot about social relations, the institution of kind of arranged marriages. Is this, do you see this as like a social critique of of Chopin's contemporary society, or is it more about kind of the ways in which Russian colonial power like reified these relationships? Like what is he criticizing? And do you think that's coming from like the Jadid in him? Is this kind of a typical Jadid critique, or is there something else unique going on here?
I think it's a very typical Jadid critique, and one that worked as a socialist critique of the Russian Empire as well. So that's a lot of what's coming through here, and that's where I think the novel would be useful, teaching how the early Soviet Union allowed particular Jadid critiques to fit with. Or the early Soviet Union made room for particular Jadid critiques to work with socialist critiques of empire. Yeah, so that's where this would be useful for teaching post-coloniality too.
And if you don't mind, I was actually, another thing I was thinking about is kind of moving the conversation in a different direction. I was curious about your experience kind of translating this work. You mentioned that like Chopin is a very important figure to Uzbek poetry, and even like he kind of had some, he introduced kind of some pioneering features into Chagatai poetry. I'm curious, like, one, if you could just talk a little bit more about kind of what makes him such an important figure to Uzbek poetry, what kind of changes did he introduce, and whether or not you saw them, those kind of features in his Night, and then like if you could also talk about kind of the translation process, and did you feel that like translating into English, you lose some of that context, or what is lost and what is gained through the process of translation? So that's kind of a multi-parted question, but I think really, yeah, and I can repeat it if need be, but I think we're really lucky to have the translator. So I was curious what you thought about all of these bigger kind of technical questions.
Yeah, okay. So regarding Joel Pollard as a poet, yes, he is one of the major innovators of Chagatai, and then the Uzbek literary language. So Chagatai,
would you mind elaborating, like what is meant by Chagatai and what is meant by Uzbek? And
sure. So Chagatai refers to what is kind of a cosmopolitan language of the pre-modern era. It's not a language that ordinary people spoke. It's more a language that was used for literature, for official documents. It is this admixture of Persian, Turkic, and Arabic. And there was a specific type of poetry, really based on Persian poetry, the poetry of Chagatai is based on the meters of the poetry of Chagatai are based on the interchange of long and short vowels, which actually doesn't work that well for Turkic languages. And so that was one of Chopin's innovations in creating this new Uzbek literary language in the 1920s that was more based on the way people spoke, not on this kind of ornate cosmopolitan Chagatai language. Chopin and a number of his other contemporaries introduced what's called barmo, or finger meter. It's just a syllabic meter. There are a fixed number of syllables in each line that generally does sound better, I think. That might just be personal opinion. It sounds better than the interchange of long and short vowels for a Turkic language. And Joel Pollard certainly thought that. So that's where he's the biggest innovator. He had kind of mastered this new form of meter. And then the other part of your question was just the question of translation. So what is lost and what is gained? That's right.
Yeah, and what kind of difficulties did you face when translating? I mean, this is a huge undertaking, so I'm just curious, like, what goes into this whole process? And you, as someone who is able to, like, kind of really immerse themselves in both sides of both in the original Uzbek and then kind of thinking very critically about how to render that into English, I was curious, like, yeah, well, what kind of strategies did you have for translating, and what do you think was kind of lost, perhaps, or, you know, and also gained in the process?
Luckily, there's nothing to do with meter in the original text. It's all prose. It's not like, say, André Bailly's Peterborg, where there is this meter that comes within the middle of the prose that's impossible for a translator to capture. What's most poetic in the original is something that I think I've been able to retain, more or less, are these kind of long flowing metaphors. And in fact, there's a certain indecisiveness to Chopin's, I make this argument in the introduction that Chopin has these indecisive characters that match his own indecisiveness. There's an indecisiveness in his prose. He tries two or three metaphors, rather than just sticking with one metaphor, he often tries two or three, like as if he can't decide which one is best, so he just lists them all. And then I felt I was able to capture. That's something that I can do. What was difficult to capture? Well, because it's an historical novel, and even if it weren't, it's only 20 years displaced from that time. There are just a lot of cultural realia that are hard to translate for the English language reader. So I tried my best to kind of convey that with footnotes to give context, or to gloss a few words. I wanted to gloss more words, but the publishers said, you know, you can't do that many. It'll be too disorienting for the reader. So, yeah, I guess those were some of the difficulties I encountered. Other ones were really just questions of historical detail. And so for those, I would kind of turn to experts in the field, like Adib Khalid, or Mary and Kia consulted with me on this quite a bit when I was in Indiana for a time. So there's that. Oh, okay. Now I've kind of, there were some things that I never quite solved, I suppose. Some metaphors that I asked around and I couldn't quite get at why those particular metaphors were being used or what they were supposed to convey. So I render them kind of word for word, and I'll just hope that they're the English language reader will probably can't get them, as Chopin intended them, because I couldn't get them, but they'll retain some of that beauty of the original prose. And so there's something lost and something gained, just lost to time that even Uzbeks nowadays don't know.
And I think there were other parts in the book where there were even disputes about like how something should be translated based on how one read, I don't know, something to do with the vowel harmony of the original. I remember a couple footnotes like that. Is that right?
Yeah. I kind of took a textological approach just because this is, or just because this manuscript was originally written in a different alphabet that can have different renderings into the contemporary alphabet, into the contemporary language. So I tried to warn readers about what that could mean. So yeah, there's something definitely lost there.
And so how many, I'm curious about kind of the history of different publications of the book, because as we've kind of alluded to, but I think deserves more attention, like the book was published in, you said in 1936, right?
Yes.
Yes, in Uzbek.
Correct.
And then is it translated into Russian or, you know,
not,
because
not until
what?
1988 or 1989.
Okay. So the timeline is he publishes the book in 1936 in Uzbek. He's executed as part of the Great Purges in 1937. The book is pulled from the shelves. Is that right?
Yeah. Arrested, the book is pulled from the shelves in 37. He's executed in 38.
Oh, he's executed in 38. And then it doesn't make a return until the late 80s, right?
Correct. Yeah. Oh, he's actually rehabilitated in 1956, but for whatever reason, he's still kind of considered untouchable. And there are even stories of someone trying to, or actually the scholar who's most, who was Chopin's biggest advocate in the 1980s and got this novel republished in the 1960s, tried to republish a few poems of his, but the publication was stopped by Rashidov himself, or Rashidov being the first Communist Party secretary in Uzbekistan in the 1960s.
And so were you using the original 1936 publication when you were translating, or did you consult multiple versions of the text? And did the Russian translations help you at all?
Yes, to all of those. So yeah, I was using the 1936 text, consulting with all these other ones. There's this great academic version that came out recently that was really helpful. And yes, the Russian translation was helpful as well. Stéphane Dourignol has a French translation that my French isn't that great. So I only used it on those parts that I had real trouble with. I put that French into Google Translate and then I'm like, oh, okay. got the gist of it.
And what happened, I think another question I had was about the fact that actually this, it's called Night and Day, but we only have access to half of the book. Do you know, like, was the other half, so it's Night and Day, so you have translated Night here. Do we know what happened to the original text of Day? Was it even completed? I know this is kind of like a historical mystery, but I was wondering if you could share a little bit of information about the kind of second half of the book.
Sure.
Or the sequel, rather.
Right. Yes. He did plan a sequel. I'm trying to think. He mentions having already completed a sequel in a 1937 article. And the NKVD reports, which I haven't seen, but they've been quoted to be, or they're quoted in a book by an Uzbek scholar, report that a main.
So this is the secret police,
right? Report that a manuscript was confiscated from Chopon when he was arrested in 1937. So that was probably the sequel. There were some rumors that the sequel had made its way to Xinjiang, but those are probably rumors. And my understanding is that the NKVD, if they couldn't make any more arrests using the material that they confiscated from someone, they would burn that material. And so that's probably what happened.
This is really interesting because I think there's kind of a like an interesting history here of the several translations. And for that reason, I think it's really important that you translated this text. I guess, how do you deal with the issue of writing, of translating half of the text? And then, I mean, do you have any kind of ideas of what he might have written about in the second text? Or is it all based on speculation at this point? I mean, so there's no archival history of who someone else who might have read this text or something. It's completely lost as far as we know.
As far as we know, there might be archival evidence. The secret police archives in Uzbekistan were open for only a brief time in the 1990s and only to a select few scholars. And now I believe they're closed to everyone. So it could. Or there could be a report of some secret police officer having read it. It's entirely possible, but I can only speculate as to what it contained based on the other things that Chopon has written. And I do that a little bit in the introduction. But I think my main argument would be that the incomplete form as we have it now, the lack of this sequel, serendipitously conforms to Chopin's aesthetic of kind of incompletion or indecisiveness. This book lacks an ending, much like his characters lack a kind of conclusion to their narrative selves. Is that an eloquent way of putting it?
Yeah. That's actually like a really good way of kind of wrapping up this. There is a little bit of tragedy that the reader has to deal with in seeing that, like, you know, especially considering the way that he was executed and then the way that his work was potentially lost. I think it does create for a kind of interesting connection between the reader and that historical period. And I think that's like what you've just said is actually a really good way of conceptualizing that. I think that's also a really good place to kind of end our discussion. So Chris, I really wanted to thank you again for your time. This has been a really interesting, and somewhat atypical for us, discussion on not a scholarly piece of work, but actually this translation. And I'm really confident that we've piqued the interest of our listeners about this, this valuable contribution. So I wanted to thank you for coming and thank you for putting all this effort into the translation process. And I was hoping before we part ways that you could tell us about any new projects, either translations or publications that you might be working on.
Sure. Yeah. I and another group of scholars are hoping to put together an anthology of Central Asian literature that would include translated literature from all the five republics plus Xinjiang, and that's in progress now. We're getting submissions. We haven't yet received all of them. And then the next thing I'd like to do is translate Abdullah Cahor's Tales from the Past. This is a novella that was published in 1966 about the author's childhood reminiscences from the pre-Soviet period and It is a socialist realist text. He shows almost in the same, in a similar way to what Chong Polo does, kind of the terribleness of the pre-Soviet period, with the implication that the Soviet period provided a panacea to all these societal ills. But it's fairly interesting, and again, it can be used to talk about the unique situation of post-coloniality. Is the Soviet Union post-colonial? Is it? Or does it continue to be a colonial state, and how? And to what extent was that perceived by the authors of these texts? So yeah, that's the next project.
Those both sound really great, and you know, I definitely am looking forward to that, and I hope that you'll decide to come back onto the show and give us another interview. And I just wanted to share for the listeners, if you liked the interview and the themes that we are discussing today, please check out Night and Day, originally written by Abdulhamid Sulaiman Oghle Chopin, recently translated by Christopher Fort and published by Academic Studies Press. And on that note, Chris, I wanted to thank you again for coming on the show. And yeah, we look forward to your future translations. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for having me.